Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, let me just ask you, are you beginning to wonder if all of these candidates really want to be president?
Well, they certainly want to be the Republican nominee.
Do they really?
I think they do. I think, look, in the old days, we would measure a candidate's seriousness by the amount of money they would raise and the amount of campaign organization they had on the ground. And all we're seeing now, this whole race seems to be who's the best debater.
That's right. Well, we used to talk about endorsements, too. That used to be a big deal. We used to talk about a lot of sort of traditional measures. And now it seems as though you don't even see the candidates going into Iowa and New Hampshire to spend all their time. Some do, but for example, Mitt Romney, who is one of the front runners, putatively, has only been to Iowa four times this year. He's going in for the fifth time now in a matter of hours. The fifth time in Iowa? I mean, that's very non-traditional.
Look, clearly the race for the Republican nomination started late. Clearly, the Republicans didn't know how to handle the numbers with Barack Obama. For the longest time, the president was seen as if not a shoo-in, certainly a clear favorite for 2012. And then said, wait a second, you know, with the faltering economy, maybe this guy is vulnerable and ripe for the taking. And yet here it is, you know, fewer than 7 weeks before the January 3rd caucuses. I was in Iowa a couple of weeks ago. There was no indication at all, really, that the caucuses were coming up on January 3rd.
It is so odd in a way, because you did have the debates beginning very early. You do have now eight or nine candidates out there running around. And even if it's not clear that the president is going to be terribly vulnerable a year from now, he's vulnerable now. He's been vulnerable even more so at some points during this past year. We really have no idea what November of 2012 will look like. But there are a lot of candidates out there. There's been a lot of early focus on trying to break out as the anti-Romney. Mitt Romney, of course, kind of in cruise control, just sort of controlling his little part of the Republican Party.
Running against President Obama
and
not the rest of the Republican field.
And running and being very sweet and kind to the other contenders in the debates, even when they come after him, being sort of indulgent of the others. He's been in control in one sense, but of course the polls showing a lot of dissatisfaction with him among the Republican base voters, and so those people are looking for an alternative. There's been a lot of energy, but it's been largely expended in cable television debating and in battling for position in the polls, and to some degree in fundraising. We haven't seen the candidates on the ground
in the
usual way.
Like Ed Muskie crying on the streets of Manchester. I mean, we don't see those kind of events anymore. And when you think of the rising and fallings of all these candidates, Tim Pawlenty, Michelle Bachmann, Rick Perry, Herman Cain, now Newt Gingrich, all of those came from good or bad performances in debates.
That's right. And they, in a time, in a moment, seem to be rising as a potential rival to Mitt Romney. But then they get into trouble when more traditional kinds of measurements are applied or when they have bad moments. And, of course, in just the last few days, we've seen another real forehead slapper when Herman Cain went to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, sat down in the editorial board room, and was asked what seemed like a pretty obvious question on foreign policy. Did you agree with President Obama on Libya?
I do not agree with the way he handled it for the following reason. No, that's a different line. I got to go back. See, got all this stuff twirling around in my head.
It was an astonishing performance. A video camera sitting right in front of him. People are still trying to figure out how in the world he could have been that on vacation in the middle of an editorial board interview.
And, of course, this comes at the worst possible time for Herman Cain because he's on the defensive. He should be. Any other candidate would be on the defensive for a slew of sexual harassment allegations aimed at him. But it seems like almost that he's prospered by these allegations. He's raised more money than before. He's been on, his supporters in the conservative media. Basically, they put the onus on the women themselves. Like, they're out to get Herman Cain.
That's right. And he's prospering because people perceive it in exactly those terms. In these polls that say Herman Cain is doing well, we're talking about him doing well because he's got 15, 20, 25% of the Republican vote, which is to say he has a minor fraction of what is a minority party vote in the United States. So we're not talking about overwhelming support in the polls. But we're talking about a position.
No, I agree with you completely. And as you're saying that, I'm thinking here we have Mitt Romney all this time as the putative front runner, the guy everybody says, oh, he's the strongest candidate against President Obama in November. All the endorsement, if we're talking about endorsements, it's Romney who's getting the bulk of the endorsements from Capitol Hill and elsewhere.
And would get even more if he wanted even more.
And yet he also has this 20, 22, 23% in the polls, not moving up, not moving down. And for all the mistakes and the fumbles and the gaffes of the Herman Cains and the Rick Perrys of the world, there's not been an improvement in Mitt Romney's standing. They've been, okay, well, let's try somebody new. And now the new is Newt Gingrich.
New is Newt Gingrich, which is, of course, the opposite of new. We have seen Newt Gingrich back into the 1970s, had his first interview with David Broder in 1974. I mean, this is not a new face on the block. But we're seeing, at least momentarily, a new angle on Newt. The idea that he would come aboard as kind of the adult in the room, the intellectual in the group, the person who knows the most about Washington, the person who knows the most about foreign policy, somebody who can go toe-to-toe with the media and, again, benefit from people's natural resentment of the media,
especially
of the news
Republican
people.
Side.
And that's true particularly on the Republican side, although they seem to be just as resentful of the Fox questioners, like Chris Wallace, just as resentful of the CNBC business reporters who were questioning their candidates. So it does seem to be an anti-media bias on the part of some of the people in these audiences, at the very least. And that's what's made some of these candidates get a little boost out of the debates. At different times, different people have been in the anti-media martyr role, if you will. Bachman's been there. Cain's been there. Now it's Gingrich. But immediately, as soon as Gingrich starts to rise in the polls, what happens to him?
What happens to him is Bloomberg News reports that the fee he had with Freddie Mac, between $1.6 and $1.8 million, Freddie Mac is one of the organizations that Newt Gingrich has been railing at for years.
Carpet bombing.
Yeah, that Barney Frank should go to jail for his activities with Freddie Mac. And then when he's asked in a debate what he did to earn, and back actually during the debate, we were talking about $300,000, not the $1.5 million that's since come out. He says, well, it was as an historian.
His first response when the question was first raised by John Harwood on that CNBC business debate, the economy debate, his first answer was, what, $300,000? I was there as a historian. Yeah. I was telling them to do exactly the opposite of what they did. Well, all right, that didn't sound too good that night. I'm sure a lot of historians had a good guffaw at the idea of somebody paying them $300,000 for that as a historian. But then, of course, it eventuates that it's the much larger figure that you mentioned and that he was providing what's known here in Washington as strategic advice.
Well, especially Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae needed that kind of advice with any kind of to get any kind of influence with Republicans, and one would assume that Newt Gingrich was the conduit to the conservatives and the Republicans who never cared for Fannie and Freddie.
And although the original question from Harwood was about a contract in the 2006-2007 time period, it turns out he was advising them way back to 1999.
Right after he left Congress.
Just months after he left Congress, when he still had the strongest of his ties to the people who were still there, many of whom were still his friends and allies. So the story completely blows up. He then says, well, you know, those amounts of money, they're pretty standard. They're pretty typical. I don't think that's going to play very well at all. The worst thing here is the dollar amounts and the people he was getting them from, and then, of course, turning around and trashing those same people in the most public way possible.
All along. And the thing is, the thing with Newt Gingrich is that we, the media, not the voters, but we, the media, decided last June that he was finished because his campaign staff imploded. All his top staffers left him, and most of them went to Rick Perry. Once upon a time, Rick Perry was the guy to go to.
That's right. And they were largely responsible for getting him into the race
Up
and running.
And the same thing happened to John McCain in 2007 when his campaign staffers left, when his fundraising apparatus seemed to weaken. We said he was finished, and we said Newt Gingrich was finished. But again, we're not talking about it doesn't matter what kind of organization you have. It doesn't matter, again, campaigning in, you know, Des Moines and Manchester and Concord. It matters how you do in a debate. And let's face it, like him or don't like him, feel he's condescending or not, feel he's arrogant or not, Newt Gingrich is an effective debater.
That's true, and that's why he has gotten his moment in the penalty box. One person after another has had a good debate. You mentioned Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain. And after that, after a good debate and a rise in the polls, then they suddenly become the focus. These negatives come out. Media, if you will, refocus, give them some scrutiny. bad stories come out, they drop like rocks. And we'll have to see if that happens again now with Newt, but it certainly seems to be happening just in the first few hours of this turnaround of his particular fortunes.
You know, we're talking a lot about style and polish in debates, but there is some substance that I think much of the media seem to ignore or just not care about, and I'm referring to the most recent debate, the foreign policy debate, when it seemed to me that military action against Iran was thrown out there as if it was a walk in the park, like it was like, well, you know, hey, I have a great idea. Let's bomb Tehran. I mean, I don't understand the cavalierosity, the Cleveland cavalierosity, and also about waterboarding. Oh, that's
gotta
fine.
Do it. Gotta
Hurricane,
have it.
Great thing. Michelle Bachmann, great thing.
Big ups.
It seemed like to me that John Huntsman and Ron Paul were the only adults in that conversation.
Yes, and they were essentially saying, look, waterboarding is torture. Everybody knows it. We're better than
it's
that
illegal.
As a country. The John McCain position, essentially. And, you know, I just want to mention one quick thing about John McCain and the comparisons that are made between the collapse of his campaign early, back in 2007, and his long slog back up to the top and winning the nomination. The difference there was the reason that that campaign staff got fired was because they were complacent and they were sure that they were going to win, and they spent a lot of money that they didn't have, and they misbehaved in a sense as a staff.
Right.
That's why he fired them
right.
And started over again at a lower level and built back up and eventually won the nomination.
As opposed to the Newt people who basically left the campaign because they thought Newt was not serious enough.
It was his misbehavior.
Right,
he ran off to the Greek islands.
On a boat.
And some other things that happened with respect to his own personal finances that convinced them he wasn't serious about running for president.
But that goes back to your
very
argument.
Different.
Remember, for the longest time we kept saying Herman Cain is really not running for president. He's selling a book or he's delivering pizza.
That's what he's mostly been doing is going to book events. As opposed to campaign events all along.
And that was the knock on Newt Gingrich for the longest time, too, that he was giving speeches, he would bring in more clients, he would sell his books, his and Callista, his wife's books, and he was not
building
serious.
His brand. He was building his brand, which is serious in its own way.
Yeah.
But the idea was that both with Cain and with Gingrich, they were not that serious about actually winning the nomination and actually being the president of the United States.
What astounds me, and look, with about 40-plus days to go before Iowa, if Mitt Romney is putatively the guy who's going to give Barack Obama the toughest fight, why don't Republican voters see that, or don't they care?
Because they don't trust him. I would say for one short sentence, they don't trust
right.
him. They're afraid that he's going to go back to being the Massachusetts liberal Republican or moderate Republican that he was as governor, or certainly that he was when he ran against Teddy Kennedy for the Senate
before
in 1994.
2007, right.
Way back to 1994, he's the guy out there talking about kind of being pro-choice, kind of being for gay marriage
right.
or at least gay rights. Well, I mean, they are desperately afraid.
You don't even have to go back to 94, 2002, when he was elected governor of Massachusetts. He ran a centrist, if not left-of-center campaign.
Well, at least centrist for Massachusetts,
sure.
which for the rest of the country looks pretty left.
And left-of-center for the Republican Party, certainly.
And that's why they don't trust him. They would, in the end, hold their noses and vote for him in November 2012 against Barack Obama. I have no doubt of that.
But if we don't trust Mitt Romney, do we trust Herman Cain, who essentially declared a pro-choice position on abortion during a recent interview?
But voters don't know that, by and large. The people who are saying they favor Herman Cain don't know that, by and large. They know 999. They know impressive speaker. They think he would be an effective foil in the fall campaign against Barack Obama.
Okay. Well, I think 999 has become 911 now because of all the things he's been saying. And you also have the Newt Gingrich alleged flip-flops. We should have a no-fly zone in Libya. Then when President Obama declares a no-fly zone in Libya, he
then
says, I'm not for it. The Paul Ryan thing, it was a radical right-wing thing to do. And then, of course, he had to backtrack on that. This is the Harry Reid race all over again. Harry Reid is the incumbent, the senator from Nevada. Everybody hates him. They're going to vote him out.
Least popular senator in America.
They're definitely going to vote him out in November.
He's gone.
And yet, It just seems like every time we keep saying how much trouble that President Obama is with the unemployment rate, with the economy being in the state it is, with the feeling of gloom in the country that's certainly out there, and then you have all these candidates where everybody says, well, you know, we have big problems with them.
All right. There's always an issue we like to talk about in the podcast that might be resolved before any listener actually hears the podcast, just to build a certain amount of suspense. And right now, that is the report from the super committee. Ken, are they going to trim $1.2 trillion from the federal deficit in the next 10 years?
How about by next Wednesday at midnight?
Well, that's the time frame. Yeah, that's the time frame. And really, if they're going to get it to the CBO to be properly scored by Wednesday night midnight, they should have it to the CBO well before Monday so that CBO can have 48 hours.
Well, perhaps the news of the week is that Pat Toomey, the conservative senator from Pennsylvania, the son of Saka Toomey, of course, he proposed $300 billion in additional revenue, which sounds like taxes to me.
Well, it's things like taking away the mortgage deduction for second and third homes and so on.
But first of all, the Democrats dismissed that immediately as just too little.
But why did they do that? They did it because the price for his $300 billion
was making the Bush tax cuts permanent.
Which blows an $800 billion hole in the same base. So it's really a $500 billion tax cut that he's proposing.
Right, but at the same time, you also have the Grover Norquist of the world to say, wait a second, you know, no tax increase, period. No ending of deductions, period.
Right. Make the Bush tax cuts permanent. Yes, he was for that part of it. But no, you can't have the $300 billion. So in Grover Norquist's world, the Pat Toomey idea was a non-starter as well.
There was a headline in the New York Times that said that super committee may push off their decision. That's a shock to people who
may defer.
People who follow what's going on in Washington.
You mean delay?
Delay, right. Not the Tom delay, no. But the typical delay, which
the
is known
traditional
with, exact delay.
Delay.
Yes.
You know what Congress is doing today?
No, what
they're grilling chew on Solyndra.
Oh yeah, well I think these little
delicious.
Soy sauce.
You should have some of that. Yeah. Steve Chu, who is the Secretary of Energy. And I always have trouble remembering the Department of Energy, but he's the Secretary of Energy.
It's the third.
Yes, and he is also a winner of the Nobel Prize. Is that correct?
That is
physics?
Correct. That is correct.
And he is sitting there now being pounded hour after hour after hour by congressmen. You know, these are the people who are popular around the country. And they are pounding him because he was Secretary of Energy at the time that grants were made and loan guarantees were handed out, obviously way too fast and without nearly enough rigorous review in an attempt to get people to develop these solar panels that would make possible green energy and, you know, move us forward economically and create jobs and the dawning of the new age in which we wouldn't need fossil fuels so much. This is a pretty good size scandal. This is one of the two biggest scandals of the Obama administration Fast and Furious.
But explain why it's a scandal, though.
It's a scandal because $500 million, $500 million in tax guarantee loan guarantees were backed up by taxpayer dollars. And it appears that this company, Solyndra, out in California, made a lot of these panels without selling them because they didn't have a market for them yet. But they went ahead and spent all this money, and they couldn't make good on their loans. Therefore, the loans had to be paid off ultimately by the taxpayer, maybe not dollar for dollar. But the taxpayers were exposed for the bad business practices of Solyndra, and Solyndra had a lot of political connections to the Obama campaign and administration.
That's where the scandal comes in, because first of all, if $500 million was given to this company because there were Obama fundraiser folks behind this company, that's a scandal. That the company instructed everybody to not report their losses until after the November 2010 elections because it would look bad politically, that's kind of a scandal.
Yes, you're absolutely right that there are a lot of ifs here. I mean, did this depend on that? Is it just bad optics, or was there really some kind of corrupt practice here where somebody was getting a contract because they were a fundraiser for the Obama campaign? In a sense, that's already been accomplished. The story is on page one. The story is on television, particularly in this particular time frame. It's already out there besmirching the administration and making the administration look corrupt. But we did get some good news in this past week.
Well, we saw the reappearance in a broadcast interview of Gabrielle Giffords, the Democratic congresswoman from Arizona who was shot in the brain last January, a horrific tragedy. Six people were also killed, 13 people injured. And, of course, Gabby Giffords has not come back to Congress to vote for any amount of time since then, understandably. And there was an interview with Diane Sawyer this week. She looked better than we hoped, I guess.
Remarkably good.
Yeah. I mean, look, are things perfect? No. Does she have trouble constructing sentences? Of course. Is there any guarantee she will run for re-election in 2012? No. And I'm sure all she wants to do is get better. But just seeing her answer questions, as horrific as the tragedy was, it was a feel-good moment in a time when not much is feeling good.
That's right, an inspirational moment in a non-inspirational year, certainly for the institution of Congress. And that's it for this week's Political Podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Ilving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. Like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind. Keys that jingle in your pocket, words that jangle in your head. Why did summer go so quickly? Was it something that you said?